Good morning. I hope that was worth the wait. I apologize for the delay there, and I appreciate your indulgence as we solve our technical challenges. My name is Darren Kopic. I'm the President and CEO of ARA, and I want to welcome each of you to the convention this year and to New Orleans, a place that we haven't been in a number of years. Let me start with a couple of things. A lot of people have been asking me about my little appendage here. And I had rotator cuff surgery a couple of weeks ago, and so it's patched, it's on the mend. And I don't even have a great story to tell about how I got it, so I made one up. Richard Gupton on our policy team decided that we needed a copy of the Healthcare Affordable Care Act in printed form in our office. And so when they brought it in with the forklift, I tried to pick it up so I could read it and tore my shoulder up. The other thing, and this is mainly for the benefit of those that were with us in Doral last year, if we could just observe a moment of silence. Thank you. We had a very in-depth conversation with the hotel at contracting time to say, there will be no construction, please. And it's worked out really well. They've been very good. As you all know, conferences like this one have many moving parts, and they require the support of a lot of people to make them work. I want to thank several of our sponsors who are helping us with this morning's program. Breakfast this morning was sponsored by Bayer Crop Science. I know Al Luke is in the room somewhere. I saw him. Thank you, Bayer. And our morning general session and refreshment break is sponsored by CF Industries. So, David Hopkins, thank you for that. Out of respect to your neighbors and our speakers this morning, please silence your cell phones if you haven't done so already. I got mine done, so it won't interrupt me at the podium, but please do so if you can. To get us started on the right foot and to give us a welcome to the state of Louisiana and offer blessings and an invocation to the Lord, I'd like to introduce a couple of student leaders who are with us today. From the Louisiana State FFA Association, they're here to welcome us to their home state. Joining us are State FFA President Kristen Wall and State Parliamentarian Nicole Rufner. So I'll invite both of them to the stage. Please welcome them.
When most people hear the word Louisiana, there are a few words that come to mind. Gumbo, crawfish, jambalaya, New Orleans, Mardi Gras, LSU Tigers, Duck Dynasty, and of course, alligators. This year, as my state FFA officer team and I were on our way to the National FFA Convention, we told ourselves, now the real question is, are we gonna let people actually believe we have alligators in our backyard or not? Now, of course, it is not common for people here in Louisiana to just have alligators roaming around their property, unless you're from my family. Whenever I'm asked the all-too-famous alligator question, my answer is a little bit different. You see, my family business is alligator farming, so people normally get a little bit confused whenever I respond by saying, yeah, actually, I do have alligators in my backyard, about 30,000 to be exact. But I love telling people all about alligators because I am so proud of this unique culture that I come from here in Louisiana, and I'm always eager to tell people about it. I'm so glad that each of you are here today and have the opportunity to experience it. Although I do love my LSU Tigers and the food here, there are a few different words that come to mind whenever I hear the word Louisiana. Home, family, one of a kind, and still alligators. Now, while each of you are here for the next few days, I hope you not only get to experience our culture firsthand, but you allow Louisiana to grow close to your heart just as it has for us. Take time to embrace our family atmosphere so you can call the Pelican State your home away from home. On behalf of the Louisiana Association of FFA, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome you here to the Agricultural Retailers Association Conference. And as we say down south, laissez les bons temps rouler, let the good times roll. Thank you.
Please assume and add it to your prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank you for today, and we thank you for the opportunity to come together as one at the Agricultural Retailers Association Conference. As we get together and learn about different ways to produce more food for the world and to reduce hunger within the world also, that we keep an open mind to new ideas and different things that can help us throughout the next couple years to produce more food. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Thank you, ladies. Also joining us from FFA today in the audience our State Executive Secretary Kathy Connerly from Louisiana FFA Association, and Kent Chesky from the National FFA Foundation. So please say hello and welcome them to our meeting. Thanks for coming. We've also invited representatives from another student organization working with agricultural youth here. FFA is focused primarily at the high school level, and a relatively newer organization called Ag Future of America is focused at the collegiate level and doing exceptional work in connecting students with employment opportunities, training them up, developing leadership, and so forth. And so I want to introduce a couple of our guests from AFA. They're not speaking this morning, but I'd encourage you to visit with them at the breakouts in the hallways. Chat with them. They're very interested in developing internships and other types of relationships, so we're very pleased to have them here. Let me ask our guests to stand. Marjorie McGill, a student ambassador from University of California at Davis. I think she's around somewhere, but I can't see. You probably can. There she is. Emma Likens from University of Nebraska-Lincoln. And accompanied by Mark Stewart from the National Staff. Thank you to AFA for being here with us. Our conference theme this year is Navigating the Path Forward, and it ties directly to many of the components that we've put into the conference, from breakouts on the Mississippi River and people management and those kinds of issues, structural change in the industry and how that's affecting all of us at every level. And our planning committee has put an incredible amount of thought and work into designing the program. And so when you receive that post-conference survey at the end of the week, please take a few minutes and let us know how we did, what we can do better for next year. We're always trying to improve this meeting. We have a total of 6 different breakout sessions this year, each one of them offered twice, and so you'll be able to choose 2 of the 3 in each one of the rotations. This afternoon, we have a lineup of 3, including Conversations with Ease, featuring Randy Kratz from the U.S. Farmers and Ranchers Alliance. This is a workshop giving people tools and equipping them to take the message to your own social networks, you know, your own community, your own school groups, your own service clubs, and so forth. Because as a lot of these issues begin to migrate from the national level to state, city, county, and local ordinances, it's important for us to be able to have those conversations one-on-one in our own communities to advocate for our industry. So that's going to be a good workshop. We have one on responsible ag nuts and bolts this afternoon. We will do an official launch announcement later in this session. But if you're curious about what all the details are about responsible ag, come to one of those sessions today, and they'll be happy to share those with you. We have the third breakout today is Mom and the Mississippi. And I will leave it to Howard Brown to tell you what MOM is all about. That's his acronym, and so I won't steal his thunder. But it's all about water quality issues, how it affects the Mississippi River, some of the legal issues around that, and how that's going to affect our businesses. And then tomorrow, we have another set of 3. One is called Dude, Where's My Rail Car? I love that title. And that's really about rail logistics, but also we'll spill into barge logistics. I know that the problem we had last winter has not worked its way out of the system. And so we've asked a couple of industry experts to come and visit with us about what that looks like going into the winter of 2014 and 15. We have a breakout on Talent in Your Backyard, showcasing some companies who have done an excellent job in developing local relationships to bring people into their companies. And perhaps in non-traditional relationships to help people know that, hey, when I get out of this school, I can go to college and then go to ag retail, or I can look at an ag retail career or some other combination that might not involve a four-year institution. So that'll be an interesting one to see. The 6th session is a business case for cover crops. And I know a lot of you, especially in some of the Midwestern states, have been dealing a lot with cover crops. And so we have an expert speaker to come in and share with you why it makes economic sense for your customers, and therefore for you, to take a look at that cropping system. So those ought to be informative. We're looking forward to hearing about those. It's a great pleasure to introduce our first keynote speaker this morning. Mike Vandelot was born and raised in Green Bay, Wisconsin. So I assume that means you're a Vikings fan. Is that right, Mike? He'll probably straighten that out when he gets up here. After obtaining a bachelor's degree in agronomy and a master's in plant breeding from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, he joined the Wisconsin Extension Service. After a stint with Supercross Seed Company, he joined Land O'Lakes in 1990 as their corn product manager. He's been at Land O'Lakes for 23 years in a variety of roles with Winfield Solutions and is currently Winfield's executive vice president and chief operating officer. He serves on the boards of Crop Life America and Ag Future of America. He and his wife, Paulette, have two grown sons, and they reside in Eagan, Minnesota. Please join me in welcoming Mike Vandelei.
Good morning. Good morning. Is there a clicker? There a clicker? No. Well, I'm sure I have one coming. So first off, great opportunity to be here to talk to you today. My first slide here is my reps and warranty slide, right? So there's no guarantee that anything that I say today is going to make any sense at all. It's all opinion. It's offered free, which puts a value on it. If it was worth more, I'd be a crop consultant, a consultant that didn't have any P&L responsibility, which would be a better job that I have today. Can you hit the next slide? So it's a great time to be in agriculture, and of course, a lot of change. And basically, the conversation that I'm going to have is. You know, there's changing dynamics, there is changing innovation in our space, and it's all coming together all at one time, and that's going to drive some very logarithmic changes in our business. And basically, five pieces I'm going to talk about. The first one is starts with the economics of food production, right? And it's the change of global food production from being, global food production from being supply-driven to demand-driven. And all of us in the room here that had the great opportunity to be around in 1983 when the government owned so much corn that they gave farmers corn, not to plant corn, all understand the dynamics of what I'm talking about in terms of agriculture being supply-driven versus demand-driven. The second piece here is, as was stated, I'm a plant breeder and I can't help myself here, but I think another big change is what's happening in the world of molecular plant breeding, and just a couple quick numbers to talk about what that has meant. So 2012, hottest, driest year we ever saw, U.S. average 128 bushel. 1988, the second hottest, driest year we ever had, 83 bushel. So over a 50% improvement in a hotter, drier year, considerably hotter and drier. You know, that says one piece of what's going on. And then let's take a look at 2014, where by the time the data comes in, we will have smashed the previous record in corn by 10 bushels, and think of what that would have looked like if we would have planted on April 15th instead of May 15th. So genetics is having a huge influence in our business. The third piece here, which is, you know, and I'm going to steal David Freeberg's presentation from the Climate Corp because he states this so well, but what sensor technology is going to mean to us in agriculture and the insights that we're going to get, that's going to be a very revolutionary thing. And, you know, as Dave mentioned, you know, this whole sustainability environmental, I mean, it is kind of interesting that we're here in New Orleans, you know, 50 miles away from the dead zone in the Gulf. And if we don't think that's a very important topic, you just need to walk around Washington, D.C. and start talking to senators and congresspeople who make legislation. And it is very, very much on top of mind. And then the fifth piece here, I'm only going to have a couple of slides on it, but you know, the innovations in application equipment, when we take a look at, we're in the ag retail business, I think is the fifth piece, because that piece is going to be key in delivering, you know, the four of these things that we're talking about. So I want to start with this economics, and, you know, these are statements that everybody knows, right? World population is going from 7 billion to 9 billion. Global food production needs to increase 70% over that time. You know, but probably a number that kind of says it a little bit better for me is this piece about every year global corn demand is going up 500 million bushels. So 500 million bushels, that's, you know, that's 3 million acres of prime $15,000 an acre Illinois ground. And as we all figure out, we're not going to create those acres. There's no more of those acres to go get globally. So that really tells the story of the efficiency that we're going to have to get in agriculture. And then this third piece about, you know, diets improving with the rapid growth of the middle class. And, you know, I heard, you know, people always saying it, but this map here from National Geographic says it so much better. So on the map here, the size of the country is proportional to the population today versus the black dots that showed what it was in 1960. So you can see where all the growth in population has been. But when they talk about the emerging middle class in India and China, and you look at that map and you go, oh my God, that's what the market absolutely means. And I had it even explained better to me by the head of the dairy business at Nestle's. We happen to have the board in Switzerland. And here's how he said it to me. He said, you know, our most profitable business in India is we sell this 10-cent packet of milk, of non-fat dry milk. And he says, you know, when people leave poverty in India and start to enter the middle class, the very first thing they do is stop on their way home and buy these 10-cent packets of milk for their children. And that all of a sudden, you know, makes this whole, what does it mean about middle class in these countries? It means that they start eating animal protein. They rather eat chicken and pork than eat tofu, and they'd rather fry their rice than boil it, right? So, you know, and when you start thinking about animal protein, that's the magic word for all of us in the room, right? Because to make animal protein, what do you need? Corn and soybeans, right? And that's an important piece in my business, and I'm sure it's an important piece in everybody else's. But, of course, we all know what the challenges are. Limited resources, at most 12% there's only 12% more land to be able to go out there and get. Only 5% of it will be projected to get by 2015 because it has so many environmental issues. And the demand for water in a few years is going to outstrip supply because agriculture is the number one user. So this really pretty much puts into focus the challenge. And, you know, the good news is that we're actually pretty good at it. So when you look at the graph here, you know, that bottom line there is indexed inputs at 1948 level. And then, you know, indexed outputs is that top green line. And we've already increased 250% in terms of output per input. But, I mean, to put it into language, you know, in 1990, one farmer fed 10 people. Today, they feed 150. You know, 25% of people's income in 1930 went for food. Today, it's less than 10%. And in 1930, 22% of the people were in ag. Today, it's only 2%. That's an important number when we talk about governments, right? You know, when only 2% of the people are in agriculture, I'm going to talk later about the need for us to be politically active, but when 98% of the people don't know where their food comes from, that really describes it. And the good news about this is ag retail has helped make this all happen. And all of us in the room here should feel very great about the accomplishments to date, but, you know, the challenges, you know, certainly are being laid out in front of us. But certainly, again, for all of us who were here in 1983 when the government gave away corn to pay farmers not to grow it, certainly it's been a great time to be in agriculture where we are today. You know, if you just take a look since 1990, we've increased corn yield 50% in the last 25 years. I mean, that is a really cool accomplishment, and that's helped drive profitability somewhat. And then, you know, here is the graph on where corn price has gone. And, you know, when you look at yield and price together, there's an interesting demographic there, right? So, you know, I forgot that in 1998 to 2002, the price of corn was still under $2. It averaged $1.90. And when corn yield started to go up and we didn't have the right demand-supply thing, the reward for supply and production going up was a decrease in price, and we didn't really make much gain in agriculture. But the magic happened in 2007 when you start to look at that chart, because in 2007, yield and price went up simultaneously. And as we all know, when you take a look at revenue per acre is bushels times price equals revenue. And yes, there's a lot of, you know, conversation about the price of corn right now, but when you look at it at a revenue basis, it peaked at $975 an acre in 2013. In 2000, when corn was still at $1.90, it was $225. So if you go 975 divided by, or minus the 225, $750 of incremental value. And where did all that $750 go? Well, land got some, farmers got some, fertilizer companies got some, John Deere got a bunch, you know, we all got some, even Ford and Chevy got a bunch of it, right? And this is a bad metaphor, but, you know, getting all that money in agriculture, it's kind of like heroin, right? Not only do I like what I have today, I also want to make sure that I have some tomorrow. And what the result of all this money in agriculture is really starting to drive is just a dramatic increase in research coming into agriculture. Because there's so much money there, and I'm making it today, I want to make sure I have some tomorrow, so let's make sure I come out with superior products. And if you just take a look at that, we were pretty much flat until that magic year in 2007 when both price and bushels started to go up. And look what, we're now in a logarithmic increase in terms of research. And where is that all gone? Well, it's gone to genetics. It's gone to active ingredients in the crop protection business. It's gone to biotechnology. But now there's extra money, so let's get into biologicals. You know, let's get into RNA interference. Let's get into big data and insights, right? So, I mean, there's a lot of dollars in the research space for them to spend on a lot of things, and there's no way we can think that all of that research dollars isn't going to result in a plethora of new insights and new products and new innovation coming into our business. Now, as I said before, I'm a plant breeder, and I can't help myself, but, you know, I think this genetic high-end yield potential that we're seeing from molecular plant breeding, which basically got going in about 2007, isn't one of the major drivers. And when I talk about molecular plant breeding, you know, how I try to explain it to people in lay terms, if you watch the CSI television shows, you know, the technology that's used in the show where they prove that the genes in the hair found at the scene of the crime are identical to the genes in the hair from the head of the suspect, it's that technology applied to plant breeding, where they literally take a seed, take a little chip off of the seed, and Monsanto technology, probably the best at doing it, taking a chip off of the seed, and then taking a look for all the genes that they know drive yield, drive stalks, drive test weight, drive dry down, all the characteristics, and, you know, they got about 3,000 to 4,000 genes that they're all looking for, and if that seed has 3,500 of those 4,000 genes, it goes planted in the field and moves forward in the program. And if it doesn't have it, it's dropped. And oh, by the way, that robot works 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, where in the past, you know, the bottleneck was running yield trials that you did once a year to try and put them in 40 locations and try to identify what were the highest yielding genetics. So this great efficiency has really, really had a major effect. This is a slide of Fred Bielow's that I think really describes, you know, what the effect of all these technologies coming together are, and it starts with this piece on starting in 1960 to 1985, where we started picking up about a bushel and a half a year in yield, and I call this the chemical age, right? Because this is really when we started using fertilizer and started using crop protection products, and all of a sudden yield really started to drive up when we did that. And then starting in the mid-90s, along came biotechnology. Certainly Roundup Ready gave us a much more efficacious way to control weeds. BT, you know, in the roots and in the plant took away corn borer and corn rootworm, the major insect problems that corn has, and all of a sudden we really bent that. But here we are in this age of today where I really like to talk about this whole thing about marker-assisted breeding and the effect that it's having on high-end yield potential. And by the way, you know, we have, you know, our answer plots, you know, we do million-plus small plot research out there, and over half of that is dedicated to genetics. And we have kept track of the gain. And in corn, average the last 5 years, our newest releases this year, newest hybrid releases, have been 6 bushel better than the newest ones we released last year. That's how much the potential curve in genetics is being bent up. But this is a different thing to sell, right? I mean, when you sold crop protection and when you sold Roundup Ready, if the guy put the Roundup on it right, it worked. Buying the technology basically made it work. And BT, even better yet. You buy the BT bag, you plant it, the corn comes up, it works. This whole thing about yield potential is totally different, though, because to get the thing to hit potential, it has to be managed to get the expression of the genes. So when we talk about, you know, why companies like Monsanto and Pioneer and Circa are starting to get into our space, you know, just selling potential doesn't get it there. It has to be managed. And if it's not managed, the farmer doesn't see the value, and they want to continue to get $400 for that bag of corn. And that farmer has to see the results. And are they going to leave it just to us to make sure that product gets managed right, or are they going to start to take some of that into their own hands? And, you know, when you take a look at a company like Monsanto that $14 billion in revenue, and after they spend $1.6 billion on research, they still have EBITDA of $3 to $4 billion afterwards. You know, we have to understand that they are going to be in our space, and oh, by the way, they are quite well financed. So this whole thing about insights enabling the products, the genetics to express themselves, is really the space that they're all coming after. And again, I try to come up with metaphors that make people understand it. So I use this one called rocket scientists and football players, meaning some couples tend to make children that are rocket scientists and other couples tend to make children that are football players. And if you're getting blasted to the moon in the rocket, you want to make sure that the rocket scientist built the rocket, not the football player. And if you're Aaron Rodgers throwing the winning touchdown against the Minnesota Vikings, you want to make sure he's throwing the pass to a football player and not a rocket scientist, just to prove that I'm very good at listening to the diversity people in my HR department. But the point here is that the insights that make this genetic potential realize itself is a real thing that's out there in the marketplace. And these companies are going to be in the insights. And then this is the big question, right? You know, are the Monsantos and Circas pioneers of the world, are they going to run their insights through ag retail, or are they going to take them direct to the grower? And I guess my thought on that is they're probably going to do what they do with their seed technology, right? So their seed technology, they all have plans to go through ag retail. That's part of their business model, but they also have part of this business model to go direct. So the whole thing on all this insight stuff is, where is it going to go? Who's going to deliver it? Hey, it's a battle out there, and it's up, you know, and it's up to us if we're going to win it or not. So, you know, that's, you know, pretty much how we take a look at it. So when I'm starting to take a look at all, you know, how this all works together, here are some of the core assumptions that I have in my head that as we're trying to figure out how to go forward in all of this one. And the first piece that I talked about is understanding the influence of what's happening on the high-end yield potential and what that means. By the way, you know, farmers know this. They know what's happening to high-end yield potential because they have yield monitors. Every 30 feet, yield moisture, yield moisture, yield moisture. And when you talk to the farmers in terms of the yields that they saw this year, they had spots in their field that were going over 300. And if you ask a farmer, how many spots in your fields have gone over 300 this year and last year as compared to what you saw 5 or 6 years ago, they say, oh, much, much more. And oh, by the way, they vote with their wallet because the price of seed corn continues to go up and they continue to put out their money to buy the very best bags, to the point that seed in 2013 became the highest variable input, surpassing fertilizer. So, I mean, that pretty much tells you, you know, what's going on there. And I think all of us in retail, again, is, you know, is it going to be a direct or is it going to go through retail? Being the winner in the seed battle, I think, is a really important part in terms of how we go forward. The second piece here is even faster than the improvement in yield. I was talking drought and got thirsty. But even more than the improvement in yield has been the improvement in drought tolerance, because drought tolerance was really easy to get, to know where the genes were. Everybody took their best hybrids, went out to California, where there was absolutely no rain, put them under irrigation and put them under 20 inches of rain, or 20 inches of irrigation, 15, 10, 5, and then they looked for the hybrids that yielded the best. And then when they found the ones that yielded the best, they just said, what are the genes that the ones that yielded the best have in common? They didn't know what the genes did. They just know that those genes are associated with drought tolerance. And then they went back to their robots, and made sure that their robots, when they were chipping that seed, were trying to get as many of those genes into the same seed as they possibly could. So again, that goes back to my comment of 2012, the yield being so much better than it was in 1988. By the way, in 2012, we had 17 million more corn acres in 2012, and they were all those extra acres were out in South Dakota, dryland Nebraska, Kansas, Black Sands of Texas. That's where all those extra, so they were even in drier environments than where we saw the stuff in 1988. And this is the third one here, is that, you know, because of what's happening with drought tolerance, because the yield potential has gotten so high, optimizing the water is the theoretical most limiting factor. And I usually don't like to read it, but of anything I say today, in terms of where, you know, again, my very free opinion, where this is all heading, it's this statement here. You know, the amount of high-end genetic yield potential that can be expressed is determined by the rainfall on that field in that year. I mean, that's the first most limiting factor. No matter how high yielding that genetics is, if it gets too much or too little water, you don't get it, right? But you still have to buy the seed. I mean, you still have your investment there. And in the Western Corn Belt, you know, this whole thing is enhanced even more by no-till and reduced-till, right? Because no-till and reduced-till, you know, you're not working up the ground, so you're conserving the soil moisture. And in this space, Roundup Ready was the silver bullet because it was the first time you got highly efficacious weed control without having to disturb the soil surface. And you conserve the moisture, you know. And I tell you what, in the Western Corn Belt, which tends to be a bigger footprint for the company I work for, this whole no-till thing is a big, big issue. And we all sure wish we could step back and make sure we had multiple modes of actions and not let the Roundup Ready thing. And, of course, now we have Enlist and Extend, which will get us back to where straight Roundup Ready originally was. But, you know, let's make sure that we get the stewardship piece of that right. And, oh, by the way, there's this whole issue of drift. And the very first slide, you know, I was next to Dave, and the very first slide they had up there showed the sprayer going down the field, and in the background was a house with clothes on the clothesline, right? And that's the reality of the world that we're in. So, you know, it's such a big deal for us, we got to work on it. And the next piece on this is, you know, yield potential has gotten way ahead of the management level of where the growers are at. And because potential is now here and management level here, there's this space that is the great opportunity for ag retail. If we can come in and help growers, you know, span that space, that's where we have a really nice value add, and that's a place where we can enhance our margins if we're able to do that. But the rules have changed. I mean, the yield potential has gotten so high. You know, this old traditional way that we worked in agriculture where the farmer put everything on pre-plant, you know, that no longer works anymore because the potential is so high. Just a couple of quick examples the last couple of years. 2012, southeast South Dakota. 2012, that area did 30 bushel. 2013, it got rain, 230 bushel. But if you would have put on all your inputs to get 230 bushel and got in 2012, obviously that wouldn't have been a very good financial return for you. Even a bigger one, though, for me is 2013 southeast Minnesota, where frequently they get 300 bushel corn. But if you would have put on the inputs and think of putting on the nitrogen to get 300 bushel and then get the 23 inches of rain during May that area got, not only did the grower lose most of his nitrogen, it's right next to the Mississippi River, and it's right, you know, right down river here, and the whole issue. So, you know, again, how we optimize this is a real big deal, and rainfall optimization, I believe, is really what's going to drive inputs, meaning depending on the productivity of your acre, there's kind of a base level of inputs that I put on. And then I take a look at the weather. I take a look at the rainfall. And if I get either too much or too little rain, that base coat is about all it's going to get. But as the rainfall pattern develops during the growing season and as it gets better and better, then I need to make decisions about how much more incremental input that I should be putting on that acre to try to optimize much of that high-end yield potential that possibly could pay off. And that's where all these in-season, you know, decision-making tools that everybody is trying to develop is trying to get at that question. You know, how good is it right now? And given how good is it right now and what's the price of the commodity, you know, what's the right inputs to get onto this acre as it continues to go through? And, you know, I mentioned that I'm not going to talk much about application equipment because I really don't have any expertise in the space, and that certainly is the expertise of the people at retail here. But having an insight tool that says, hey, put this stuff on, you know, that's the easy part. The tougher part is the ag retailer that says, how do I get that stuff on? And, you know, that goes to this next point, you know, about innovations in application equipment. If you can't put all the inputs on pre-plant, then they need to be applied in season. And what does that look like? And, you know, Greg Sauter, the precision planting guy that, you know, sold his company to Pioneer, he's out doing some other things now. And one of the things that, you know, I love the way he thinks, because I always look at things from a plant breeding perspective, you know, and the fertilizer guys always look at it from a plant nutrition perspective. But he's an engineer, and everything he looks at is from an engineering perspective. And you know, he gets this whole thing, too. So, you know, this is retrofitted equipment to get nitrogen on in the row. In fact, this picture is even better. because, you know, that plastic piece there on the bottom actually rides in the row and prevents it from bouncing around. And then there's some right at the bottom of the slide there, there's drip tubes that the nitrogen's being applied right along the stalks of the plant. And then he's got these sprayers that are spraying up into the canopy from the bottom up. It's like, that's a really good idea. And he sent me a movie of it. And as the thing is coming out of the field, there's this rolling thing of fog that's basically coating the plant in a prophylactic coating of fungicide from the bottom up. By the way, a lot of the diseases come from the bottom up out there in the canopy. And it's like, wow, what took this so long to happen? But in terms of, you know, think of, you know, the nitrogen or other nutritional things, fungicides, microbes, or whatever. And this is big corn, you know. This is corn just prior, you know, well, it's at R1, you know. So, you know, again, a lot of innovation in that space influencing it. So the next piece here is about the sensors. And again, as I mentioned, the next 9 slides I borrowed directly from Freeberg because he tells the story so well, but I think he's getting right at the issue here. So, you know, we look at this cornfield and we see a field of corn, but another way to look at it is digitally. And, you know, digital data is the representation of what really happened in that yield. And, of course, this is a yield map. And, you know, so, you know, we're taking information with sensors. And if you take a look at the sensors out there, you know, electronic circuits or sensors that gather this digital data are getting cheaper and more powerful, and just a 32% or 32 times improvement in efficiency per dollar spent in the last 10 years. All of these numbers, when you take a look at, you know, wireless sensors are everywhere. You know, 2012, there were 10 billion units out there. That's going to triple in just a 4 or 5 year period. And where are they going in our space? All these sensors, they're going on tractors, they're going on planters, they're going on sprayers, they're going on combines, they're going on satellites, they're going on drones, and all of those sensors are producing gigabytes of data, all kinds of it. And when you get it all, so how do you start to get it all into a place where it can be stored? You got all that data, and if you're trying to manually put it in, I mean, never happened. But we have the ability to do it wirelessly, and the wireless cost of moving the stuff wirelessly is coming down extremely steeply as well. At the same time, the amount of mobile devices that people can observe the data is going up dramatically. I mean, right now, we have more mobile devices on the planet, cell phones, iPads, et cetera, than we have people, and it's continuing to grow. And everybody has access. I mean, this is 2009 4G access. That was 3G access. This is what it looks like in 2014. This is Verizon's map. But I mean, you know, so the access to it is continuing to go up. And then the storing of the data, you know, I mean, that's the other big, you know, the whole data warehouse farmers, everybody's saying, help me with my data. I got all this. I don't know what to do with it. It needs to be stored properly. Look at this chart just blows me away. 1980, it cost $192,000 to store a gigabyte. Today, it costs 4 cents. So all of this data and all the cost of doing it all is just collapsing into the market. And, you know, they like to use this money ball. You know, people in both fields, Wall Street and baseball, operate with beliefs and biases. To the extent you can eliminate both and replace them with data, you can gain a clear advantage. It applies to agriculture as well. It's how do we take all that data, sort through it, and help make insights to farmers going through it. So sensor data from field equipment and weather, they're going to drive insights in agriculture. And sorry for this one being so difficult to read, but this is the last one from Monsanto. But it really describes it very well because, you know, they've broken it down to 40 decisions that the farmer makes every year. Now, when you sort through those 40 decisions, a lot of them influence ag retail because a lot of the decisions that they make are about are they going to use or not use the products that all of us sell. So, I mean, it is a big deal. And the real question is, can data-driven insight tools help farmers make 40 better decisions? That's really what it comes down to. And obviously, a lot of people think so because everybody is out there writing those tools. So, you know, just to give you a quick run of how Winfield is thinking about it, not that we've got it figured out. We're just out there playing the game so that, you know, at the end of the game, you know, if it's close, we have a chance to win. You know, so how we're looking at it is, you know, we're basically looking at yield. You know, it's the genetics that's out there. It's the weather that we get. It's the agronomic practices, that the farmer uses, and it's the interactions, meaning if you have genetics that do better in cold weather, you know, that's a genetics by weather interaction. And if the farmer is using no-till, which has problems in cold weather, that would be a three-way interaction. And the data that we're taking a look at, you know, the first one is, you know, traditional experimental data, our answer plot data that we, you know, that we run a scientific experimental design to look at things like how do hybrids respond to different rates of nitrogen, different populations, do they tolerate corn on corn, you know, what's the best soil type that makes them work. And then the second kind of data is data taken during the growing season. You know, what's the current state of that crop looking like? So the remote sensing, you know, be it satellite imagery, you know, our R7 system, probably look like drones in the future. And on the fertility side, we like tissue analysis because soil samples are great, but what's better is going out there in June, taking plants off of the plant and saying, what exactly is the fertility that's in this plant right now? How good does my yield look? And should I be fixing things that my tissue analysis says that are missing? And then the third piece here is the big data, you know, the predictive modeling tools at Monsanto and Circa. We're playing into that space at all. Well, but it's about predictive models that, given what's happened in that field so far, weather, planting date, all that kind of stuff, and then given what the next 10-day forecast, or better yet, if we get better at forecasting, you know, and the commodity price of the crop, what should I be investing in? And when you don't have data from the field, there's no doubt that the predictive model is going to be the best piece of information that you're possibly going to get. So, you know, when we look at traditional data, you know, we got our 1.2 million answer plots out there. It's a pretty simplistic thing. We're about brute force. You know, have 500 replications of data and go out and compare, you know, Monsanto, Syngenta, Dow, DuPont genetics to each other. Brute force, we'll figure out what the best ones are, what the best soil types are. Get our LSDs, you know, we're down to less than 2 bushel an acre, but it's brute force. So then when we start talking about optimizing genetic performance, how we think about it is making sure that the conversation with the grower starts with the field first. If there's anything that disappoints me is when I hear one of my seed guys come in and say, hey, here's our trial, here's our answer plot data. Hybrid A is first and hybrid B is second. Why don't you buy 3 pallets of A and 2 pallets of B? And it's like, you know, it's way more sophisticated, way more complicated than that. You got to start with the field. You know, what's the soil types in the field? What are the challenges that field is having? And, you know, we got 15 years of archived satellite imagery on that field, so we can find out where the bad spots are in wet years and where the bad spots are in dry years, and then have that conversation with them. Start with the field and then go to the data and say, okay, given the data, here's the hybrids that perform best nationally, but here are the ones that perform best in your area. And by the way, with our characterization, here are the ones, you know, that work on your soil type. And if you're in corn on corn, this group handles corn on corn. And these are this is how they respond to nitrogen. This is how they respond to population. And then take a look at his field. So that little line there on the right of the map, you know, given the archived satellite imagery we have, how much variance has that field seen in the past? So if the variance in the field in the past has been between 95 and 105%, it's like pretty uniform field. Probably don't need to do anything. But if the variance has been between 75 and 125%, then it says to you, gee, we probably should do something, write a variable rate map, you know, change the population, and then if that hybrid needs more nitrogen as the population goes up, we'd better have a variable rate nitrogen plan here. But that's when we start getting into this whole variable rate technology. But that's how we look at it from optimizing yield. When we look at it from optimizing plant nutrition, as I mentioned, we like to get a tissue analysis. And, you know, we have a system where you send it in today. It goes aired to Indianapolis. The analysis is done tomorrow morning. By tomorrow afternoon, the results are on the Internet. And then the next morning, you can actually be going out there and trying to solve the problem that particular field has. The other piece here is, you know, the remote sensing, the in-season imagery. And we can take in-season imagery and write a variable rate map. So, you know, for example, if you're in an area where you get rolling fields where in the dry years the low spots are better and in the wet years the high spots are better, and you had some rain early and your low spots, the nitrogen is leached out and there's some poor spots there, You know, you can at least make the decision, you know, do I want to apply nitrogen to my low spots and fix those? Or you might say, gee, my high spots are better. Maybe I should put my nitrogen on my high spots. But at least you can make the decision and use the variable rate. And then, of course, the big piece is, what's my 7, 14, 28-day water forecast? If I'm going to get above rainfall, then I want to put my nitrogen on the high spots. But if my forecast says below normal, maybe I want to put it on the low spots. But, you know, again, that's how you try to get all of this about optimizing weather. And when one of my employees sent me this map, certainly all of us in the central Corn Belt region of the U.S. this year realized, wow, this year growing season is much different than 10, 11, 12, and 13. You know, cooler, wetter growing season. And, you know, in my mind I thought, gee, you know, are we seeing a difference in the weather patterns here? And then I get this map, this heat sensor map sent to me, and it's like, oh my God, the rest of the planet was still hot. It was just, you know, our area of the Corn Belt here. And again, it just reinvents into my head how we have to understand how rainfall is such a huge player in driving the decisions that we're going to do in terms of going forward, because every year is different, every field is different. The bad thing about satellite imagery, which I love, not very consistent. You only can get an image, you know, 14 a year at the best, you know, one every 5 or 6 days. And if you get clouds, you know, now you're 2 weeks out, and during the 2 weeks of the bolt, your corn's gone from this big to this big. Now, you know, so, you know, I love it, but if you can't get it, what are you going to do? Well, this whole predictive model thing, that's where it all comes in. How much rain did it get? Can you model it? And, you know, certainly this is the way that Monsanto and Circa are going. So all of this stuff sounds great, right? And at $7 corn, it was a no-brainer. But what does it mean now that we're coming into this world of $3.75 corn? So, you know, going back to my my revenue per acre chart here, you know, 2014, some of the corn was forward priced. I'm making numbers up yet because 2014. But let's say they averaged $4.25 at $744. We're probably pretty good this year yet. But, you know, next year if we stay in the threes and trends continue to go up and we're at 180, now we're at 657, this is when we get to the farmers, you know, well, geez, you know, the price of corn is so cheap, I don't think I'm going to put any fertilizer. You know, I mean, we all know what that speech is about, right? But the thing that we have to make sure that we keep coming back to the farmers and reinforcing about is that it's not just about the price. It's about the price times the bushels, and the bushel part is really important. And this is how I talk to them, where I try to get them to get it, is that getting the right bushels is as important as getting the right price. Meaning, Mr. Farmer, if you price your corn at $5 and it gets dry and corn goes to $6.50, what do you say? You say, oh, shoot, I'm on the wrong side of the market. But if corn is at $5 at the beginning of the growing season, and you have a great growing season evolving, favorable rainfall everywhere, and the market starts to factor in a big crop, and the price of corn starts coming down because they have factored in more bushels, and if you don't go out into your best fields and the best spots in your invest fields and invest more inputs into them, you're not going to get your share of the bushels. And if you don't get your share of the bushels, you're still on the wrong side of the market. You're just on the other side of it, but you're still on the wrong side of it. So this whole thing about helping farmers identify the most limiting factor in their best fields and their best spots in the fields, I mean, that's where it's heading. And again, that's where everybody is investing their dollars. So the question then, you know, becomes, so who's going to win this thing? And to me, I always I like to use this example of 1999.com, right? 1999, all these companies, big market caps, if you had a whole bunch of money to invest, you could have invested some dollars in all of them, and then when the bubble came, you would have lost a bunch of money. But if at the time that you invested, you got really engaged and started to play the game and know what was going on and started to understand that the winners were going to be Google and eBay and Amazon and moved all your money into them, you could have made a ton of money. So the point I'm making is that we got to be really engaged in the game as it goes forward. So it's going to be about all those tools out there and the best tools. And this is the place where I believe ag retail, you know, this is where we stake our claim, is, you know, what is the best tool? And I like to use this carpenter. You know, for a carpenter, what is the best tool? So if he's looking at saws and he's cutting 2x4s to make a pallet, You know, that handsaw probably worked well. But if he's cutting 2x4s to build a house, he probably wants a table saw. And if he's going to build a piece of furniture, he probably wants a saw that's even more precise than that. So the point is that the farmer is the craftsman, and he is there about picking the right tool. And I still have the belief in how retail is going to win this versus people going direct to the market, is that they can have tools, but we're going to have the craftsman. Because what's the right tool for any particular acre? I still believe it's going to be the agronomist standing in that field, looking at the field and saying, for this field, for this hybrid, for this amount of rain, for the problems that we have here, this is the solutions we need to get to, and these are the tools that are going to get us there. He's going to be out there ground-truthing it. He's going to be taking a look at the economics. He should be knowing what tools are going to be better, and my guess is that there might be a nitrogen tool better in the drier western corn belt, and there might be a different nitrogen tool better in the eastern high rainfall corn belt. I mean, I'm not sure, but, you know, that very well could be the case. And then the point is that who's going to put all the pieces of the puzzle together to optimize it? So the last piece that I want to talk about here is the sustainability and the political piece. This is a huge deal, you know. So, you know, Land O'Lakes, you know, we're looking at helping farmers grow more food in an increasingly sustainable manner to help feed a hungry planet. And we just don't talk about it. Being in Washington, D.C. is an extremely important part, and all of us being extremely politically active is very important. You know, we had a very nice presentation on a political update yesterday. You know, when the people in Washington are in gridlock, it's where we are today, which means you can't legislate any changes, it enables the president, whoever it is at the time, to use regulatory to drive his agenda. If he can't legislate his agenda, he's going to regulate his agenda. So we got to be there, you know, really playing the game. And this, so, you know, Land O'Lakes, we did the Roundup Ready alfalfa product, and of course that got deregulated. Sat for 4 years fighting all kinds of, went all the way up to the Supreme Court. So I spent my time in Washington, D.C. a lot. And I went in to see Senator Cole, and I from Wisconsin, which is where I'm from. And I sat down, and this was about a two-minute conversation. I sat down in front of him, and I said, Senator Cole, I'm here to talk to you about biotechnology and agriculture. And just like that, he said, Mike, don't you know that 78% of their people want to know if their food has biotech in it? And I said, yeah. And, you know, we didn't do a very good job at bringing, you know, technology to the market. I said, if we would have advertised up front that, hey, we're going to have Roundup Ready corn, it's going to control weeds, optimize water, it means the price of food is going to come down. Better yet, it enables no-till so that we're not going to have, in the high rainfall areas, we're not going to have erosion. You know, it would have been a really good thing. Just like that, he says, yeah, Roundup Ready. You know, you guys created all those super weeds. And I said, yeah, but, you know, but here's the deal. You know, I said, you know, antibiotics in medicine, you know, people get, you know, we get resistance to antibiotics. We don't quit using antibiotics. We develop new antibiotics with new modes of action. And so in agriculture, we got the Enlist 2,4-D tolerance and you know, dicamba coming. And he said, 2,4-D. He says, there you go again. It says, it's, you know, that was an Agent Orange. And I said, well, you know, here's the deal. You know, Agent Orange, you know, had another molecule that one of the byproducts, you know, made dioxin. That was the problem. It didn't have anything to do with 2,4-D. By the way, they put water in it, too, and they haven't banned water since then. But the point is that he had the talking points, 84 years old. I mean, the guy could hardly walk. 84 years old. He had the talking points just like this of our opposition. So we have to be making sure that we are politically active. I'm going to go through, get to this one here. Because this is what a lot of people, you know, think sustainability is. We have to work with ARA, and we all have to be active ourselves, that we make sure that input per bushel drives decision-making, not input per acre. That slide that I tripped over just a second ago, that's from France. In France, which right now is being run by the teachers' union, that's who runs France right now, the teachers' union, and they have decided that in the next 10 years that crop protection products have to go down 50%, and 20% of the ag acres are going to be organic. They have mandated that legislatively. So, you know, we have to have and work closely with company with organizations like ARA here, and the political piece here is really important because, you know, we're only 2% and the other people are 98 and they're going to drive their agenda, so we need to be there. With that, I have gone over my time. I apologize for that, but I very much appreciate the opportunity to for a free opinion. From, by the way, the one piece I didn't say is, you know, as Howard Buffett, the one thing I do have going for me, of my 40 chances, I have 38 behind me, so. Oh, thank you. Do you have time? Or? Okay.
We have time for one or two questions, if there are any.
Thanks for that talk. I'm from California. Where California, they tend to go above the bar at the federal level. And I've sat in a meeting room with my senator, Senator Feinstein, and yes, she knows the talking points too. And I'm part of the Farm Bureau back home, and we participate in these meetings, and we go to these meetings, and we counter their talking points. But you're right, the 98% or whatever that number is. How do we realistically flood the zone, if you will, to get our message out there that all these regulations are going to lead to higher food costs? And we've got the world standard right now, but it's on a tipping point, at least in my opinion. So how do we continue to flood the zone and actually influence these people in power that are making the policy decisions? Thank you.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, I think that we have to get very factual based and we have to drive it. So, and we got to know our points too. You know, so, again, I'm going to give you the GMO one because, you know, I'm more from that part of the industry. But, I mean, I always start out with a polite conversation with them that says, yeah, I know there's a lot of concerns about GMO, you know, but you know that there's been 4 billion acres of it planted on the planet. Nobody's gotten sick. The World Health Organization and the American Medical Association have done the biggest studies that they ever did to study if there was, you know, any bad things from biotechnology. They couldn't find any. You know, by the way, you know, I'm a scientist, and from a metabolic pathway way, I can't find a way to get from Roundup Ready to how the corn would change that it would be bad for. I can't find a metabolic pathway to get there. You know, so, I mean, those are the kind of things that I try to sell them. And then, you know, and then if I still can't make progress, then, you know, get a little bit mean-spirited with, you know, so how did you get here today? Well, what do you mean, how did I get here? No, how did you physically get here? Well, I drove my car. Well, you know, so do you know how many proven bad things come out of the exhaust pipe of your car? You know, and here you're complaining about GMO and there's no smoking gun, no evidence, but your car, all the bad stuff, you know, you should buy a bicycle. You know, I mean, and again, it's, you know, it's about getting, you know, but, you know, at some point in time, you know, we really need to tell our story in a way that they understand. And that's why, as many ways as I can try to find metaphors to explain, you know, be it the CSI television show technology or football players and rocket science, things that they understand, you know, we got to be able to explain the things to them in the language that they understand so they get it, right?
Thank you. I think in the interest of time, we're going to move along, but please thank Mike Mandelot. ARA enjoys a strong partnership with a number of organizations. One of those is Purdue University. And Purdue has operated our flagship Management Academy program for a number of years. We've been working with them to add some new things to the lineup with Purdue, and so I'm going to invite Lee Stanish with Purdue's Center for Food and Agricultural Business to come up and give us an update on the Management Academy for 2015. Lee? Here he comes.
Well, good morning. We're happy to be in New Orleans from the Hoosier country, as it's quite a bit warmer down here, so we'll take it. As Darren had mentioned, for the last 8 years, Purdue and ARA have had a wonderful partnership through the Management Academy. A number of you in the room I know have probably been to visit campus and see us through the Academy. It's a 3-day program that focuses on agribusiness management, and we'd love to have you up if you've not been here. Through that 8-year period, there's been about 350 alumni now, I believe, Darren, 350 folks from your organizations that have been up to see us. And this past summer, you probably got a message from us if you had been through the Academy. We actually did a little bit of searching through a survey of what happens next, right? So the Academy has been very successful. Many have really enjoyed the opportunity and the experience to come through it. And so we sent out a survey this summer and had some discussions with the group around this whole talent management area. What happens next? What are some other opportunities? You strongly gave us feedback that something that came to the top was decision making, right? So we hear it all the time. I just talked with a grower back home, and he's been a farmer for a long time. And I said, Terry, how's agriculture different today than it was, say, 25 years ago? And he said, Lee, if I make a bad decision today, he said, it can really put me out of business. And he said, we have to think harder about our decisions. And when we think about what Terry had to say, I think it's the same in our organizations, right? So as we are in these times that are changing, that we just heard this eloquent description of, we want your managers, your folks, to be able to make better decisions within your organization. So this year, we decided to have an opportunity with ARA to do a co-branding of an additional program called Structuring Decisions, and that program will happen in June. So again, we do have a booth out in the lobbyway. I'd be happy to talk with you further about it, but there will be two great opportunities for ARA members to come to Purdue, be exposed to some of the networking and the faculty that we have there in these two particular spaces, the Management Academy and the Structuring Decisions Program. So we really look forward to seeing you and hope you can visit. Definitely stop by the booth, and we'll be happy to talk with you further.
Thank you, Lee. That's one of many programs that we've developed over the past few years to help train and develop people. That's been a continuing theme from the membership, is that we need some help in that area, and so we're continuing to work on that. We've also developed a program within the last couple of years to help member companies recognize what we call rising stars. And these are folks that are within your company that have maybe exceeded their goals for the year, or up-and-coming potential managers someday. A way to develop and connect them with others in the industry and bring them to the ARA conference. And so I want to introduce our 2014 class of Rising Stars. This program is sponsored by Yargis Manufacturing for us. And as I call your name, if you'd stand up and remain standing, and we could recognize you as a group. Brian Baer with Barnard Soil Service. Chris Beasley with Yargis Manufacturing. Kevin Daniel with MFA. Chris Gallo, JR Simplot. Kyle Johnson, International Raw Materials. Jamel Colley, South Dakota Wheat Growers. Scott Moorhead, Agrion. Rodney Steele, JR Simplot. Brandon Vining, JR Simplot. Jason Willard, JR Simplot. Would you please join me in recognizing and thanking our rising stars? Welcome. And as I consult my notes here, I notice that I skipped over the leadership at its best in crisis communications one, so my apologies to the AV crew for throwing them a curveball. But we have a leadership at its best program that Syngenta sponsors for us that helps us develop advocacy expertise. It's a program in Washington, D.C. that's done once a year, and any member company can send representatives to that. We also have a crisis communications program that FMC and CHS do for us that helps people with crisis communications. And the core example, the reason this program got started, was one of our members in California had a TV show up at their front door with a microphone and said, I understand you're making toxic chemicals that poison the environment. What do you have to say about that? What we're trying to do is help people understand that if they have a situation like that or an incident at a facility, what is the best way to manage those crisis communications? And we've had enough demand for that that we actually offered two of those this past year. But I think we had a list of the participants up there from this year's classes, and I just wanted to recognize those participants as well as our sponsors for the program. ARA has a large-sized board. We have 44 people on the board. A lot of people, especially association peers, will say, how do you do that? But for what we do, it's a really great combination of folks. And so that also means that we have people coming in and going off the board each year. And I want to take a couple of minutes to recognize those who are completing their terms on the ARA board, as well as those who are joining the board for the first time this coming year. So as I call the outgoing board members, would you please stand and remain standing? Johnny Council with Lyman Tremont, Wade Castleberry, Home Oil, Mike Karasevich, Wilbur Ellis, Tim Perotti, Carolina Eastern Vale, Jim Klein, Centennial Ag, David Hinchy, Hinchy Fertilizer, Shelley Weathers, UKT Chicago, Tip O'Neill, International Raw Materials, and Dawn Bauck, Dow AgroSciences. These folks have put in several years on our board, and I appreciate them. Please show your thanks as well. We have several new people coming in to take their seats, and I'll also ask that crew to stand up as I call your name. John Demerly, Dow AgroSciences, Jim Fargo, Centennial Ag, Brian Harrington, Carolina Eastern Vale, Todd Huddleston, Mid-Valley Ag, Troy Johnson, Wilbur Ellis, Ian McGregor, The McGregor Company, Brooke McMullen, International Raw Materials, Gary Vogan, Yara North America, and Tim Witcher from Greenpoint Ag. Welcome to the board. Thank you. And since I haven't had the current board members stand up, I'll ask them to do the same. I'm not going to go through their entire list, but we have a list on the slide for those that are on the board and remaining on the board. If your name is on that list or you're a continuing board member of ARA, please stand up so everybody can see who you are. It's a great group of people to work for, and we appreciate them very much. Now we'll give everybody who hasn't just had a chance to stand up the opportunity to stand up, and we'll go to break. Our morning session and the breakfast break are sponsored by CF Industries, and while you're up, if you're going to the AIRPAC dinner tonight and you bought one of the tickets for that event, those tickets will need to be exchanged before you enter the door tonight for a wristband. That can be done at the door, or if you want to drop by the registration desk sometime today and get that done now, you won't have to wait in line at the door tonight. So if you're going to the AIRPAC dinner, just remember that. Exchange those tickets for your wristband so you can get into the event this evening. Please be back in your seats at 10:15, and we'll reconvene. Thank you very much.